This week on Making Contact.
I think it's time for me to retire and write my next book called Why Men Kill. It's going to be dedicated to Donald Rumsfeld.
Cesar and I would be in meetings, and we'd come out of a meeting, and I would tell Cesar, these people are lying to us. How do you know? Dolores, you can't get along with anybody. I'd say, Cesar, they are lying. Of course, later on, he'd find out that they were.
Jesus with a machine gun doesn't come off as an authentic figure. So Jesus wouldn't be using violence in order to solve the problems.
Women are gaining influence as leaders throughout the world, fighting for peace, justice, the environment, and civil society. In this program, we profile three courageous women elders, honoring their lives of dedication to far-reaching social movements. Australia's Dr. Helen Caldicott is the premier spokesperson for the worldwide anti-nuclear movement. The Smithsonian Institute named her one of the most influential women of the 20th century. Dolores Huerta co-founded the United Farm Workers of America and is a tireless advocate for social justice. Mairead Corrigan McGuire won the Nobel Peace Prize for organizing a grassroots nonviolence movement in Northern Ireland. Join us as we listen to their stories, hear of their current work, and enjoy their wisdom. I'm Sandina Robbins, your host this week on Making Contact, an international program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. This program is a special collaboration with the Women Rising Radio Project.
And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware.
Helen Caldicott was a child living in Australia when the United States dropped nuclear bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, killing hundreds of thousands. By the time she was a teenager, she was keenly aware of the nuclear arms race and was desperate to save the planet.
I was 15 when I read On the Beach by Neville Shute, and it was about, as everyone knows, a nuclear war that occurred by accident and we were all dead, and that was the end of life on Earth. And that was early 50s. And that branded my soul. I was only 15. I lost my virginity. Then I read everything I could find about nuclear weapons, and at the time Russia and America were testing, so there was a lot. And then I went to first year medical school at the age of 17 and learned about radiation. And Russia and America and China were testing like crazy, and I could not understand why these men were doing what they were doing. So I've been in it for a long time. And it's a kind of desperation because I know that any day, the tick of the clock, the Earth could be annihilated. Yeltsin got to within 10 seconds of blowing up America by mistake in 1995. And that was a big article in the New York Times, but it was buried near the back pages. So this is the elephant in the sitting room that no one will address. Yet they run around the world with microscopes looking at, ooh, there, ooh, maybe North Korea is building one. Ooh, what about Iran? Of the 30,000 nuclear weapons in the world today, Russia and America own 97%. They're the real rogue nations.
Dr. Caldicott resigned from teaching posts at Harvard University in the United States and at the Adelaide Children's Hospital in Australia to work full-time on the prevention of nuclear war. She had a key role in Australia's opposition to French atmospheric testing in the Pacific. She educated Australian trade unions on the dangers of nuclear energy and uranium mining. She co-founded Physicians for Social Responsibility and Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament, or WAND, writing many books and waging a worldwide campaign against the use of nuclear power. Most recently, Caldicott focuses on the wide-ranging health hazards of the nuclear energy cycle, especially in the United States.
Most people live within 100 miles of a nuclear waste dump for sure. So they're all over the country. I mean, they had a thing called the feed materials plant in Fernald, Ohio, and everyone thought they made dog food. Well, they were machining uranium, and huge amounts of powdered uranium escaped from that plant. One little boy had an osteogenic sarcoma of his leg, and he had his leg amputated and was chock-a-block full of uranium. I don't think there's been a decent epidemiological study done of that population. God knows the number of cancers that are there and will be for the rest of time, because the half-life of that uranium is 4.5 billion years. So I mean, they do a lot of this stuff in secret, and they have since the beginning of the nuclear age in 1943. Now, the reactors, the nuclear power plants, 103 of which are scattered around the country, they're sort of sitting there relatively unguarded. There's been no increased security at these reactors since 9/11. The guards work 12 hours a day. They get sleepy. They go to sleep on the job. They have practiced terrorist runs, and over 50% of time the terrorists actually enter and penetrate the control room. It's very easy to melt down a nuclear power plant. Very. I could do it in a few hours. But the other thing is that, of course, when you're transporting radioactive waste, you need to do that in secrecy so people won't attack the waste canisters. They have to transport 1,500 shipments of radioactive waste every year for the next 30 years to Yucca Mountain, if indeed that goes ahead in Nevada, which it may not. That's called the Mobile Chernobyl Bill, because it's very easy to destroy one of those canisters and kill a lot of people. They drive hydrogen bombs around in Winnebagos with machine guns under the dashboard. A lot. You don't know the half of it.
In her recent book, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer, Caldicott argues that nuclear energy is a major contributor to global warming and pollution. As an alternative to this deadly fuel source, she proposes a clean energy plan which would save money and reduce global warming.
Well, there's enough wind west of the Mississippi to supply the whole country with electricity several times over, number one. Number two, every single building and house in America should have a solar panel. And they all should be subsidized or even paid for by the federal government, which is currently spending $70 billion every few months to kill over 600,000 people in Iraq. So let's divert this money, which is owned by the taxpayers, from death to life. Americans can save 28% of the electricity they currently use by lots of methods, but turning off your computers, your VCRs, your DVDs at night that suck out 5 to 10% of the electricity. So they're producing nuclear waste and cancers down the time track and global warming. Hang your clothes outside and dry them using the nuclear reactor in the sky. Now, that would save 20% of the electricity you currently use, which is equivalent to the amount of electricity that is generated by nuclear power. Then you can close down all your reactors. Now, how else can you save energy? Solar hot water systems, which don't use energy from the grid. Wind farms right across the Midwest and all over the country. A geothermal energy. You can heat your house in the middle of winter in Boston by just tapping a few feet under the earth and using the heat inside the earth to heat your whole building. Cogeneration, use the waste heat from industry to generate electricity. Easy. And we have to make a summary of that, a three-page bullet point summary, and put that summary in every single politician's hand in the country. Every church.
Caldicott is now an elder in the anti-nuke and peace movements and looks to the next generation of activists to stop corporations and politicians bent on building more nuclear weapons and power plants.
I've always felt guilty. I've always felt responsible for saving the planet. But as the body ages, it starts, my pipes are getting rusty like an old nuclear reactor. I think partly I have to be shut down and I don't have the energy I had, and I'm going to definitely slow down. So that means I pass the torch on to others. I gave a speech in Scripps College and wonderful young women. And I started a movement called Students for Survival. And they said they'd take it up. And I said, you've got to organize all the colleges in the country and teach them about global warming and nuclear power and nuclear war. And they said they'd do it. You know, revolutions are always led by students. And there are quite often young women who absolutely get it. They're building a huge highway, or they want to, from Oak Ridge, Tennessee, down to Savannah River to transport plutonium and huge amounts of radioactive waste and start up the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership. And I talked about that. I was in Nashville, and a young woman sat next to me as I was signing books. She must be in her early 30s. She kept looking at me at the edge. She came up. She said, I'm going to stop that road being built. And she will. So it's mentoring, but you have to wait till the souls arrive to say they'll do it.
Dolores Huerta is a legendary labor organizer and advocate for farm workers in the United States and Latin America. With Cesar Chavez, Huerta created the United Farm Workers of America, earning a reputation as a tough union negotiator and winning many battles for farm workers. Her well-known passion for justice and equal opportunity is rooted in her California childhood.
Where I was raised, it was a very ethnically mixed neighborhood. We had, you know, neighbors who were African-American. Kitty corner to our house was a Greek family. On the left-hand side, our neighbors were Italian. We had people from a lot of Filipino families. We had the second largest Chinese population outside of San Francisco. So we had large Chinese population, large Japanese. We had recent immigrants from Mexico. We even had a family from Afghanistan, I remember. And then, of course, we had the white families, the poor white families, the Okies and the Arkies, and Native American families. So it was just a really wonderful, in terms of the cultural diversity. And then as kids, we hung out with each other. We went to each other's homes. We ate each other's food. I learned how to eat with chopsticks when I was 7 years old because my best friend was Dolores' son, Chinese young woman, and I would accompany her with her Buddhist prayers, and then she would go with me to the Catholic Church. When we went to high school, it was very different. Then there was just a lot of discrimination, both economic and racial. It was almost like I call it a push-out program, you know, to get the Latino kids to drop out and the African-American kids to drop out. So high school was pretty sad, I guess, for me. It wasn't enjoyable because by the time I got to be a senior, most of my friends had dropped out of school. When I was 15 and 16 years old, I actually organized some teenage clubs. We had a storefront. We brought in a jukebox. We had jitterbug contests. And I had a place to hang out. And the police shut it down because they didn't want these white girls to be hanging around with the Filipinos and the Mexicans and the African-Americans, right? And any time that we were coming home from a football game or a basketball game, you know, we would walk home. You know, we didn't have cars. The police would stop and they would harass us. So that sort of anger builds up in you. And so I always wanted to do something about this. And I had already become involved in a group called the Community Service Organization as a volunteer. I had gone to a house meeting with this great human being named Fred Ross Sr. He showed us what they had done in Los Angeles, in East Los Angeles, where they had brought in streetlights and sewers, sidewalks into the community, health clinics, filled up the potholes in the roads, where they had elected the first Latino to the City Council of Los Angeles, Eduardo Roybal, who later on became the first Latino congressman from California. But the thing that really hooked me was when he showed us news clippings where they had sent 14 police to prison for beating up Mexican Americans. And to see then that people did have this power to organize if they came together.
Organizing became Dolores Huerta's life work. She became a master at it. Through Fred Ross, she met Cesar Chavez, and together they began organizing to secure dignity and basic human rights for those who harvest our nation's food. For decades, Huerta represented the United Farm Workers, leading successful nationwide consumer boycotts. The farm workers' movement ranks with the civil rights movement in the struggle to bring social justice in the United States.
In the community service organization, we started doing our voter registration drives and going into those neighborhoods where the farm workers lived. And here you'd go into a home where you didn't have any cover on the floor. It was dirt. And the furniture were wooden apple crates or orange crates. And you saw kids running around barefooted because they had to save their shoes to go to school, and with raggedy clothes. And in fact, when we first started, farm workers could not even get the surplus commodities because a farm worker had to live in one county for 12 months and show rent receipts or utility bills for a consecutive 12-month period. And so that was one of the first fights that we took on in the community service organization to change that law so that a farm worker, at least if they lived 12 months in the state of California, would be able to get surplus commodities. People were just barely surviving, you know, barely surviving. There were no toilets in the fields, no drinking water in the fields, a lot of children working in the fields. Yeah, it was awful. And then, of course, the way that the workers were treated, treated very brutally, as they still are to this day, where workers do not have union contracts, they're treated very brutally. They're abused by the employers. When we started organizing, that's when they had the Mexican contract workers. They called them braceros. Today's language is guest workers. They would send the braceros back to Mexico in stretchers, you know, ill, not cover their injuries at all. Today, this is what our president is saying. Let's bring in guest workers, which means bring people in from their native lands, work them and send them back to where they came from without their right to have residency or without their right to become citizens of the United States of America. And it's a slave program is what it is and should not be supported by anybody.
Huerta is concerned that current U.S. foreign policy in Latin America is colonialist and results in more poverty, displacement, and misery to Latin American people, causing more desperate immigration to the United States and exploiting workers everywhere.
And American companies take out all the resources of those countries, take out the profits of the countries, and the people there just become wage earners, right? And at very low wages, you know, at poverty wages, where they really cannot even afford to live on the wages that are being paid. And at the same time, their own economy is being destroyed by our policies of economic colonization. And then we blame the victims, right? We blame the people that are coming here that are escaping starvation. Now with these new immigration laws where they're making people who come to the United States to work, making them criminals and felons, and anybody who helps them to be criminals and felons, this is just horrible. So it's been a very ongoing political attack against labor. And it's very scary because when you lose the labor movement, you lose labor organizing, then you really are erasing the middle class of a country. And when you erase the middle class of a country, then the democracy is actually threatened. And that's what's happening here in the United States of America. So all of labor is right now in the crosshairs, not just the Farm Workers Union. When you talk about the minimum wage, I mean, the minimum wage right now today should be closer to $20 an hour. And they're talking about, you know, giving a raise to $7 an hour. So it's a misery what they're talking about, raising the minimum wage. We have these communities in the San Joaquin Valley, which are unincorporated communities where they still don't have sidewalks. There's some places in the San Joaquin Valley where people do not have drinking water. Would you believe this? I mean, I've been organizing now for 50 years, and I go back to some of these little towns, and you see that they're pretty much in the same stage as they were 50 years ago. And these are the people that create the wealth through the work that they do in the fields, and yet none of that wealth comes back to them.
Despite the setbacks, Huerta has never wavered in her commitment to nonviolent social change. She's endured brutal police beatings and numerous arrests. She's been on hunger strikes and marched thousands of miles. She's crisscrossed the country, speaking out on behalf of oppressed people everywhere. She's been building up the Dolores Huerta Foundation, and lately she's focusing on the need to empower more women.
I think it's very difficult for women. My difficulties I had in the movement is always with the other men. They would not set so much Cesar himself, but the other men who would always try to challenge my leadership. And when we look at our world, we know that the only way that this world is going to be made right is by having women in leadership. When we talk about why do we need women on boards, be it school board, legislature, it's city council, et cetera, and definitely the Congress, is because if women are not present at the table, they're going to make the wrong decision, okay? They need a woman's intuition, a woman's wisdom to be able to make the right decision. When Cesar and I would be in meetings and we'd come out of a meeting, I would tell Cesar, these people are lying to us. How do you know? Dolores, you can't get along with anybody. I'd say, Cesar, they are lying. Of course, later on, he'd find out that they were. How did you know? That was my women's intuition, right? My women's wisdom that would say these people are lying to us, right? So our women need to understand that they have strength and they have power and that they should not let anybody take away that power from them or dominate them. Si se puede. By the way, I'm the one that came up with that saying. And in the Latino world, this is a big thing. And a lot of people give that credit to Cesar because he always used it. Right, but I'm the one that initiated that. And that's true about a lot of things that women do, right?
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Today's program is a special collaboration with the Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. If you'd like more information or for cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit us on the web at radioproject.org. In 1976, Catholics and Protestants were on the brink of a civil war and deadlocked in a bitter conflict with the United Kingdom when Mairead Corrigan McGuire co-founded a group called the Peace People. Its aim was a nonviolent, demilitarized Northern Irish society and a dialogue of reconciliation with Southern Ireland. More than 500,000 people attended Peace People rallies from both Northern and Southern Ireland. The Peace People was an idea born of a terrible tragedy to Mairead's own family.
When the trouble started in 1969, I was very conscious that violence was increasing and things were getting very bad, wanting passionately to try to stop the violence, but not necessarily seeing the way to do that. But tragically, on August 76, one of my younger sisters, Anne, went with her four children to visit my mother. And on the way, the British Army patrol killed the young IRA man, shot him through the head. His car went up off onto the footpath and it pinned my sister and three of her children against school railings. And her three children were all killed. Only one of the children was saved. So it was that tragedy really that I felt it was time that all the violence stopped, and I called for an end to the violence. Another lady called Betty Williams simultaneously started collecting signatures and calling for a rally. So within a few days, we met a young journalist, Kieran McKeown, and the three of us realised that people were ready for a peace movement and we needed to mobilise and organise. So that was the birth of the Peace People in 1976. And we said there is an alternative to militarism and to paramilitarism and deep ethnic political problems such as we have in Northern Ireland can only be solved through all-inclusive dialogue. Now, it took a long time for that message to actually come to fruition when we moved into a Good Friday Agreement and a political process and people recognised these problems can't be solved through violence.
The Nobel Committee didn't take long to recognize what the Peace People had been able to accomplish so quickly in Ireland. They awarded Mairead Corrigan McGuire and her co-founder, Betty Williams, the Nobel Peace Prize in 1977. Since then, McGuire has been a worldwide spokesperson for peace. She sees her commitment as a natural outgrowth of her own spiritual path.
Receiving the Nobel Peace Prize carries with it a responsibility to be able to both continue on your work for peace and non-violence where you live, but also in any way in which you can help other people who are working around the world on issues of peace, if that is non-violence, nuclear disarmament, saying no to war, conflict resolution as an alternative to using war and nuclear weapons. So, I mean, I have really then spent my life helping other people where I possibly could. But I had also come through before the Peace People started a spiritual journey of asking the question when one lives in a situation where there's not only paramilitary violence, but state violence. Because, you know, we lived in a situation with the British Army on our doorstep where we lived under draconian legislation, internment, and people brought into the prisons and held for up to 7 days. I mean, state injustice is very, very difficult for ordinary people to deal with. And I had to come through, do you ever, ever take a gun to oppose state injustice? I read the necessary qualifications for a just war and I went to the cross and asked, what would Jesus do? And I very clearly came into the absolute conviction that Jesus said, love your enemy, do not kill. Jesus with a machine gun doesn't come off as an authentic figure. So Jesus wouldn't be using violence in order to solve the problems. I think Christians too need to be less punitive, less judgmental, and more compassionate to the suffering in the world. I would love to see that the current Pope and other spiritual leaders, I would love to see them coming together to say that the just war theory is not in the spirit of Jesus, who was totally nonviolent.
Recently, Mairead has called for an independent inquiry into the United States government's practices of torture and rendition. She also participated in an international trial at The Hague, which indicted the governments of George Bush and Tony Blair for war crimes. She is deeply concerned about American violence worldwide.
You know, if America sets aside all this international laws and human rights, what can we say then to dictators in other parts of the world who are carrying out torture and abuse of their citizens? It means America, God help us, has lost its moral authority to speak to the world and is no longer a moral leader. And that is tragic for us all. So I think we have to demand accountability before the laws for those who right at the top are sponsoring torture, and also Bush and Blair, who took the world to war against the wishes of the majority of the human family, have to be held accountable before the international courts. We have to do that to protect our human rights, our international laws as a human family.
McGuire appeals to the people of the United States, and especially American women, to demand that the U.S. government stop pursuing war as an answer to conflict.
Well, I think the role of women is a wonderful example of what happened in the mid-70s when the peace people started. One of our first rallies in Finicky Road North, the day after the three children were buried, the women from a local area had hired a bus to come and join us at a rally that we had called, and some boys got onto the bus and said, you know, they were IRA and the women should get off the bus. And the women said, you know, burn the bus if you want. We are staying on this bus and we are going to the peace rally. That was a tremendous example of women coming out of areas where paramilitaries were operating and yet having the courage to take a stand for peace and say there is an alternative. So my message is to the American people, particularly to American mothers, come out now and demand that your children be brought home from Iraq and stop supporting war and militarism, because the madness of militarism is just horrific. There is another way to solve our differences in the world today.
That's it for this Women's Desk edition of Making Contact. These profiles of international changemakers were co-produced with Lynn Feinerman's Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. You can learn more about the work of these courageous women at radioproject.org. If you'd like to order a CD of this program, our toll-free number is 800-529-5736. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Additional music by Sarah Thompson, Susan Pena, and Randall Bays. Special thanks to Stephanie Welch for production assistance. Lisa Rudman is our executive director. Peggy Law is our founding director. Senior producer, Tina Rubio. Dorian Taylor, communications manager. And I'm your host, Sandina Robbins.